Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Thomas Lindsay. He's the executive director and an attorney for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which has assisted close to 200 communities across the country in 8 states to adopt binding local laws that elevate community rights to sustainability over corporate rights and powers. He's also done tremendous work worldwide on the rights of nature. So first, thank you, as always, for your great work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on, Derek.
So I think we've known each other for almost 30 years now, and a question I don't think that we've ever asked public, or I've ever asked you publicly, is can you talk about the evolution of your thought from, I mean, how did you, where did your interest in rights of nature or community rights or stopping the madness around us, where did it start? Did you spring full blown from your mother's womb this way?
Some days I wish, because we'd be a lot further along than we are now. But I basically traced that evolution back to deciding to go to law school. And the decision to go to law school was basically premised on, we have, you know, in the United States, all these great environmental laws, and felt that the best way to make change in the world was to become a lawyer and then to begin to enforce and those environmental laws and defend protection of the natural environment. And law school is a really bad place for kids to go in, because basically, you know, the joke is it brainwashes you, it extracts your cerebrum out of your ears and then injects cheese whiz back in. And on the first day of law school, they tell you that their job is not necessarily to teach you the law, which most people think that's what law school's for, but to teach you to think like a lawyer. And thinking like a lawyer means fitting you into the existing structure and system that is. And there's very little space created, almost none, for people who want to think outside that system and outside the box. And basically question, you know, how we arrived at this place in the first place, and that it's the result of an evolution of the law and protection of property and commerce and the large economic actors and all those things. But there's really no space, there's no breathing room at law school to actually have those conversations, really. So they generate automatons. And so whereas I first started going to law school with a small group of people who were like-minded and wanted to do public interest stuff, by the time you come out of law school, it's whittled down to just a couple. You know, I think there were two of us at the end. And again, the whole frame when I was in law school was the U.S. has these great environmental laws. We're the leader in the world on environmental protection. And the reason why the world's going to hell is that there's just not enough lawyers enforcing those laws. And back then, same number as today, but there's only about 250 full-time public interest environmental lawyers pro bono in the United States who can actually work on behalf of community organizations and nature. And so when I came out, I thought the problem was pretty simple, which was that we didn't have enough lawyers enforcing the great laws that we had already in the United States, and we decided to create a nonprofit organization, the law firm, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which would provide legal services to community and neighborhood groups for free. And these weren't, you know, the Sierra Club or Environment EDF or any of the big groups. These were community groups that came together around a toxic waste incinerator or a factory farm or a frack well or something that, you know, their vision of sustainability, their vision of protecting their community and quality of life and the natural environment didn't include a 20,000 head hog factory farm being plunked down in the middle of it. And it was there that we started my evolution, at least, which was that we would represent those communities and go through these permit appeals, because most all of the projects involve some kind of permit being issued to the corporation to put in the particular facility. And as we were fighting the permits, our job was solely to find the gaps, omissions, and deficiencies within the permit application as per the state law that governs the issuance of the permit, and then argue to a judge that the permit had been issued wrongly by the state agency and that it should be overturned or not have issued, that it was a mistake. And we won a bunch of those cases. In fact, we won almost all that we brought. But the problem was the corporation would simply come back and fill in the gaps and omissions that we had found. And in fact, I had some of the, you know, law firms and lawyers from the biggest corporations in the United States coming over and thanking me after we had won these cases, because it meant that the law firm could bill more hours to the corporation to fill in the gaps and omissions and deficiencies that we had found in the original permit application. And so the first part of my evolution, at least, was about what's the deal? You know, these environmental laws, these highly touted environmental laws and this permit and regulatory system they have in the United States that's supposed to be about protecting the natural environment and these communities was really nothing more than us assisting the corporations to build better permit applications to then put in the project that they had originally conceived. And it was at that point that we began questioning our own reality about whether we should exist or not, because, you know, I didn't really want to be in a position where we were helping corporations build better permit applications, but instead wanted to work on stuff that actually stopped these projects from happening at all, if the community deemed them, you know, unworthy or not sustainable or not within their vision of what the community should be. And so it was then that we switched gears, to do something different, which is what we do today. But a real understanding that the law was never intended to be on the side of these communities. It was never intended to be on the side of nature within these communities, that the entire legal system that we have from the Constitution on up, and actually embedded in the constitutional provisions is all about protection of commerce and property. And the basic raw fact is that it's not the communities that are seeking to engage in these commercial projects. It's the corporations trying to put them in, and the law is on their side. And even if you find something by accident that temporarily delays or stops something from coming in, the corporate boys simply go back to the legislature and rewrite the permit guidelines. So it made us not only question our own reality, but also question the reality of all of these environmental groups working across the United States, especially the big green ones, the larger organizations, about why continue to work within that structure and framework when it was never intended to use for that. And even when we hijack it for some other reason, that the powers that be on the other side have the ability to come in and simply plug those holes. And so I think that was the first place where we really ran up against the wall.
A big moment in my evolution of thought was something called the salvage rider, which is where I was part of a group that was part of a larger group across the country that was filing timber sale appeals, doing exactly what you say, that the Forest Service would put out a timber sale, and we would find flaws in their analysis, that they had not done enough research on how this will affect northern goshawks or what will be the effects of this on bull trout. And so we would file the appeal, and then they would be getting paid, you know, the individual writers are probably at that point getting paid $40,000 a year, the tech writers for the Forest Service, to rewrite the appeal, and we're getting paid nothing. And they would rewrite the thing, it would still be illegal because all the timber sales harm the environment and they violate all these laws. So we would keep winning appeals, and people like us around the country were able to shut down the timber sale programs on a lot of national forests. And as a result, the federal government passed a law basically saying that, and we'd been saying the forests are in a state of ecological collapse, and they said, yeah, they're in a state of ecological collapse, which is why we have to cut them all down. And they passed a law saying that any sale that was determined to be necessary to salvage the timber or for forest health would not be susceptible to environmental regulation. And the long and short of this is that when we figured out how to use the rules against them to actually bring about some environmental sanity, they simply changed the rules.
Yeah, I remember that time well. I was actually sitting in a forest in eastern Oregon at a conference when the salvage rider stuff went through. And as you say, it exempted certain timber sales, which became almost all timber sales, from the requisites of the National Environmental Policy Act, which required environmental impact statements to be done. And that's how the timber sale appeal process actually worked, was through that federal law. But it's, I guess one of the things that we've come to as an organization is helping people see patterns. And what you just said, what you just covered is a pattern. It, unfortunately, it's a pattern that only people intimately involved in the process generally learn, and it's not a pattern that people outside of the process can see. But it reminds me of, you know, going through law school, one of the case studies was the Tellico Dam in Tennessee, where the Tennessee Valley Authority was putting in the dam, and it was going to wipe out the last population of snail darters. And this is always used as, you know, a success or a victory case for the Endangered Species Act. At least that's how it's taught. So when you open up the environmental law book and you come to the Endangered Species Act section, they're talking about how great the ESA is. Then they use the Tellico Dam project as an example of how successful the Endangered Species Act is, because people sued and the Tellico Dam work on it was stopped as a result of the lawsuit to save the snail darter, which is a small species of fish. But later I learned that, you know, after that victory, which is all that's covered in the law textbooks, Congress simply went back and exempted the dam from the Endangered Species Act. So they passed a federal law that exempted the dam from the Endangered Species Act and other environmental laws. And then they built the dam. And the snail darter population was wiped out. And I'm like, where's the victory in all that? I mean, I don't get it. And, but that's not what's taught. And what's taught in law school is that there's some kind of huge victory. And they do the same thing with the other environmental laws, NEPA and other things. And I guess we've come to a point where I would ratify and validate what you just said, which is that when we're successful enough, which we were over a period of 10 years doing permit appeals and this kind of stuff, we stopped all kinds of things temporarily. But eventually they would move forward. And I remember this one case that stands out in my brain, just like TVA and just like the salvage rider law, is that we stopped this basically timber harvesting operation. It was a grinder. They took small circumference trees and fed them into a grinder, and it was a chip mill operation kind of thing. And we stopped the chip mill because we brought a permit appeal, and a permit appeal was successful. And then the agency, the environmental agency in Pennsylvania, retroactively permitted the thing, because our loss, our challenge was, hey, you don't have a permit to operate this chip mill, so you should be shut down. And the agency retroactively permitted them, so going back to a date certain to eliminate our permit appeal, and then faxed them the retroactive permit. It was like, just in the, you know, it took us all these hours, and like you said, we weren't being paid, you know, like the other side was, and these regulators were, and the industry was, and we managed to win something, and then the agency simply came back and retroactively issued a permit, which I had never seen before, but now doesn't surprise me.
So before we move on, there's a quote that I'm going to completely butcher, and I hope you can talk about just a little bit, which is, some president in the early 20th century put in place, I think it was the Interstate Commerce Commission, and the government was getting complaints from the railroad people saying, how dare you regulate us? And there was somebody, Secretary of Commerce or somebody, wrote back and said, hey friend, don't worry about that. The purpose of this is to essentially insulate you from the outrage of the public. And if we didn't put this in, they would rise up with their pitchforks. But don't worry, it's not actually going to regulate you much. Am I completely – do you know what I'm talking about, the quote?
Yeah, I know exactly. It was Richard Olney, who was the Attorney General of the United States, and Teddy Roosevelt's – I believe it was Teddy Roosevelt's guy. But the Interstate Commerce Commission was the first regulatory agency in the United States. And you hit it right on the head, which is, in fact, we use it on our democracy school, so I was pulling the text right now, but the quote we use is, and this is the Attorney General in 1893 assuring the president of the Burlington Railroad that the Interstate Commerce Commission would not be an issue because it was a regulatory agency, but it wouldn't have any real power. He said, quote, the commission is or can be made of great help to the railroads. It satisfied the popular clamor for a government supervision of the railroads at the same time that the supervision is almost entirely nominal. Further, the older such a commission gets to be, the more inclined it will be to take the business and railroad side of things. It thus becomes a sort of barrier between the railroad corporations and the people. and a sort of protection against hasty and crude legislation hostile to railroad interests.
Well, that's about it. Thank you very much. Thank you for isn't that basically the entire discussion of regulatory agencies right there?
Yeah, although it's tough to relay that understanding to people who think that the regulatory agency's job is much different than that. And sometimes we answer that in two ways. One, we say it's not called permitting for nothing, that permits are actually a permit to do something that would otherwise be illegal, that it's an authorization type of thing that's being issued. And then the other thing is people come to us and say, well, the regulatory system isn't working because it's not protecting our health, safety, and welfare, to which we sometimes say, well, maybe it's working perfectly. It's not broken. In other words, it's functioning just the way it was intended to function. And I think those patterns have become increasingly important as we can show them from place to place in a contemporary real-time setting. But we use our democracy schools to talk to people about what the intent of the original regulatory agency was, and it was the Interstate Commerce Commission stuff.
And, you know, sometimes I talk about, and other people I respect talk about how regulatory agencies are captured quite often. But that quote kind of makes it so that they're not actually captured, but they were instead captured as they were born in captivity, as it were.
Yeah, I think it's sexy to talk about, well, the agency's been captured, or the agency is doing something other than what it was intended to do. We don't talk in that language anymore. It's because the history is pretty clear. It's the intent of these regulatory agencies to take control over that permitting regulatory process to protect certain interests over others. And almost never are the interests protected, the actual interests of the community itself, or, of course, further relayed from that or tangential to that under the current system of laws, nature itself, which has less protections than the community itself does.
So you're going along, fighting these permitting processes, and you're realizing that this is not always actually stopping the destructive activities. And so what was the next stage in your evolution?
Well, luckily there was a group called the Program on Corporations, Law and Democracy around. So a group called POCLAD, and one of the leading lights of POCLAD, founder in fact, was a guy named Richard Grossman. And Richard had written a bunch of booklets and a couple papers about how the corporate system was set up, but more importantly, tracing backwards, you know, Richard was an activist in environmental and labor circles, and he wondered why all their battles over the past, you know, his 25 years of activism had always been against the corporation. What was it about the corporate form? Why were they always battling a corporation? Why was that always the entity on the other side of the battle or the struggle? And so they started to do a deep dive on what a corporation is, and where does a corporation get permission to operate? How is a corporation chartered? And what's the history of corporations in the United States? And how do corporations get constitutional rights in the United States? All these basic questions that other activists weren't looking at. So other activists, you know, working at the very top, front line kind of stuff, something comes in the door, you gotta put on your boxing gloves and go to work. But one thing that we've missed as a movement, whether it's labor or environmental movement, is basically that underpinning stuff to open up a new offense, a new front line, to basically begin to question that very fundamental aspect of what a corporation is and why does it have such power in this society to do whatever it wants, whether that's through taking down campaign finance laws, or engineering our permit regulatory process, or destroying the environment as property. I mean, where all these concepts come from, why are corporations the main movers and shakers behind those? And so that had a big influence on me, coming at a time when the permit regulatory stuff, I could see a pattern emerging about why it was ineffective and what its original intent was and why we were stuck in that hamster wheel or feedback loop, that we couldn't get out of. And so the question to me was, okay, given that, and this history of corporations and corporate personhood and the power that corporations wield, then how do you do a different kind of organizing that not only tries to stop the immediate harm that's coming into these communities, whether that's a frack wastewater well or fracking or toxic waste or whatever the harm is, and actually get people to understand that they're on the receiving end of 200 years of a very carefully calculated, manipulated, constructed system of law that guarantees that they're going to lose. And I think that, you know, putting it in shorthand, we call it putting it on the ground. You know, how do you actually put boots on the ground or implement that concept so it's not just a airy-fairy idea floating out there, but actually it's part of and integrated into the organizing, that unless people begin to start aiming at structural change, we're always just going to be chasing our tails in permit, regulatory proceedings, appeals, trying to enforce existing environmental laws. And what does a new kind of environmental law look like along those lines where people actually have the decision-making authority to say no to a pipeline coming through, for example? And what rights should a community have? What rights does a community have to say no to those things coming in that are going to damage their health, safety, and welfare? And on top of that, what rights does the natural environment have? Because when a pipeline gets laid through a community, it doesn't just affect the Homo sapiens that live in the community, that the community is bigger than that. It's the biotic community as well, and that the biotic community has to have some control over what happens also. And so that has taken 15 years to actually figure out how to effectively and efficiently put that on the ground in terms of integrating it into a grassroots organizing strategy, and then having the lawyers back that up with going into courts and arguing this new concept of law and attempting to change the landscape of how this system actually operates. Because I think more and more people are finally beginning to see the patterns that are emerging from this type of system that we have, and understanding that it's got a shelf life, and the shelf life is rapidly approaching.
So when can you talk about the two-layer strategy that you have had in your community organizing, that a question that you once asked me to ask you was, I was interviewing you on stage one time, and one of the questions you wanted me to ask you during this interview was, so Thomas, you are helping people to organize in their communities to have community rights, the community rights to control whether there's a factory hog farm comes in and destroys the local landscape, and yet when you organize these communities, you know that quite often they're going to get crushed by the Commerce Clause that leaves interstate commerce to the state and to the federal level, not to the community level. So basically, and I'm sorry for the aggressiveness of this language, but this was what you asked me to ask you, is why are you wasting all these people's time when you're going to help them organize and then they're going to get crushed?
Yeah, I love the interviews where I can ask other people to ask those questions.
That's my favorite question I've ever asked you, by the way.
Yeah, so the first, it depends on who we're talking to, but my first response generally to that is, what's your option? I mean, you can go through the permit regulatory stuff and try to make that stuff work, but it's not going to work and you're going to lose. So, if you're going to go down that path, wouldn't you want to give yourself at least a shot of winning something? You know, making new law or moving in an area that actually permanently protects your community? Because this year it may be frack wastewater injection wells. Next year it's going to be a factory farm. The year after that it's going to be water withdrawals. I mean, the resources that are in the community are going to be taken constantly, because that's what this is. It's a resource exploitation model.
But 20 years ago, I was in this group of sort of sustainability people. There was about 20 of us, 1997, 21 years ago. A group of, 20, 25 of us were brought together in Washington, D.C. to talk about changing agriculture, changing corporate rule, etc. And at one point, toward the end, the guy running the thing, the moderator, said, I want everybody here to imagine that it's 20 years from now and that we have achieved some sort of sustainability, which of course is a riot in retrospect. And I want you to tell me what this community smells like and looks like and feels like. And everybody goes around. These are good activists all around. And everybody in the room is describing this wonderful community where you ride your bike to work and you have all these parks and everything smells wonderful and everything's great. And they get to me, and I'm just squirming my seat the whole time. They get to me and I say, you know, I'm sorry. If we in our community develop this little sustainable, happy situation, and then suddenly those in power decide that there are resources under our land that they want, everyone in this room knows what's going to happen to our community and knows what's going to happen to us if we resist. And so you can't talk about one little community absent the entire capitalist infrastructure. And of course it was just like I had passed gas at a garden party, you know? Anyway, so sorry, I just wanted to put that in.
No. I mean, the divergence of some of what we do, there's some similarity to what we do with that, which is that people in communities, like, and let's get rid of the abstract. So like a small rural community of 500 people in, Pennsylvania. So, you know, in fact, there is one. It's the Grant Township over near Pittsburgh. So it's about an hour out of Pittsburgh. It's the most rural area possible. And the folks in Grant Township, a small group, came together and said, this is what we want for Grant Township. Our vision for the community is this. And they had a firm hold over that, about what they thought that their community should look like and should be, and believed that they had the power to actually build that community. And then a company came in and said, we're going to put a frack wastewater injection well in the middle of your community, and we're going to pump the equivalent of the 10-second flow of Niagara Falls into the ground each year for 10 years of toxic wastewater from the frack wells that we operate from this region. We're going to truck it all in, and we're going to dump it in this hole, and then after 10 years, we're going to cap it, and it's going to remain there in perpetuity. I mean, that was the plan. So people in Grant said, well, we have a vision for our community, but it doesn't include that frack wastewater injection well. And they came face-to-face with the understanding that the system of law, even though it's their vision of sustainability for their community about what they want to protect and how they want to live, that the system of law that we have doesn't allow them to have it. Because they have a resource, and their resource is storage. That's their resource. Their resource is space and drilling below the aquifer to actually put this huge amount of wastewater in so the corporations can continue to do the fracking operations in the region. And so the organizing that we do is, it's simple at one level, which is people say, well, this is the kind of community that we want. And to my surprise, in many places, people have never been asked that question. People have been disempowered so much that they don't even think they have the authority to answer that question, let alone have it. But to actually say, this is what we treasure and this is what we want our community to look like. And then they come face to face with a system of law that not only doesn't allow them to have it, but involuntarily thrusts a project into their midst that will destroy everything that they treasured and valued within that community. And that ideally should produce a number of people who ask why. Why is the system that way? And why are we on the delivery end of that? And what do we need to do to change that? Ideally, that's what should happen. Unfortunately, we've been so dumbed down in this culture and trampled and, you know, the violence to non-white communities and just ripped out of us like entrails. Any understanding of ourselves as decision makers or commanders of our fates, or even having the confidence in ourselves to believe that we should have the authority to dictate that future. And so our work, whereas it looks simple on the surface, which is what do you want? What can't you get under the existing system? And what do you need to do to actually build a new system that allows you to get what you want? I mean, that's the straight line, A plus B equals C. There's a reason why that doesn't happen in our culture. And the reason it doesn't happen is that, number one, we're not raised to think like that. Our brains have been bored out. And second of all, even when we do, we get punished. It's like Pavlov's dog. Even when we dare to believe that we have the power to decide what our own future should look like, then a corporation or other business entity comes in and pounds the crap out of us and punishes us for actually having the gumption to have that vision and actually try to implement it. So we've been trained very carefully, like the dog in the Pavlovian experiment, to not think that way anymore. And it's divested huge segments of the population from even thinking that they have a right to say what happens to their community or what doesn't, and have, in essence, involuntarily, in some places voluntarily, given up that decision-making control to someone else. And that someone else is more than happy to use it because their values are exactly opposite to the values held by the community. So our job is to bring people through. We're like, you know, the guys with the lantern that just show the way. We say, you're not alone. Other people are going through this. This is why. We give them the stuff so they can understand the situation that they're in. And then they have to make voluntary, informed judgments about how far to take that. So in Grand Township, for example, we have elected officials in that little township who have done amazing things. Like, first they pass an ordinance banning the frack wastewater injection well, and then challenging the authority of the corporation to assert its rights within the community to put the injection well in. That was huge. Judge came in, overturned that after a corporation sued. So corporation sued the frack wastewater injection well corporation, got it overturned. Judge put out a decision that said, nope, it's illegal and unconstitutional to do what you guys are trying to do. At which point the people of Grant, the small rural township, put up their middle finger to the judge and passed by popular vote a new home rule constitution, a new charter for their community, which reinstated what the judge had overturned in the first round. So here's a federal judge saying, no, you can't do this. And here's a community that understands enough about the system and how it operates to say, we're going to do it anyway, and we're going to do it by popular vote, and actually put that back into place. And then there are elected officials saying openly now that the community is prepared to file for bankruptcy, that they're willing to file for bankruptcy in the face of a damage award that the corporation would sue them for and have sued them for, waiting for a court decision now. So the question is, not only how do you help people see the pattern that we're in and how the system operates, but how do you help them do and take the actions that they need to take to begin fixing that thing? In the end, in some ways, what we end up telling people openly, or, you know, through the imaging and the pattern recognition stuff, is that if you don't want a frack wastewater injection well in your community, you have to change the constitution. You have to change the DNA of how the system operates, because it's like a snowball rolling downhill. As soon as that permit application goes in, all rights accrue to the corporation and the property and commerce that the corporation represents to put the thing in. And so, you know, if I'm living in a community, I don't want to fight under a system that's been pre-written for me that I understand I'm going to lose, and I may get, you know, higher fences or different color fences around a frack well as a result, but I'm still getting the frack well. Versus moving in a new direction and trying to win something that's actually going to permanently secure rights for the community to say no to these things coming in into the future. So again, at one level, it looks fairly simple what we do. At another level, it's exceedingly complex because people's brains have been colonized in a certain way, not even, so they don't even believe that they have the power to do what they eventually need to do.
So when somebody defies a community or an individual defies a judge, or more broadly the entire system, you mentioned how they can get punished for that. Do you want to talk about that more?
Yeah, so the first way they get punished is by being sued, and a lot of communities, municipalities, are so afraid of being sued that they'll repeal the ordinance as soon as they get sued. So this new law that they put into place that codifies their vision for the community, they give it up so quickly when the lawsuit comes in the door because they don't want to be sued. And under the law that we have today, corporations can not only sue the community for passing the law and get it overturned, but they can sue the community for damages. Damages as a result of not being able to put the project in that they're seeking to put in, mostly in the form of future lost profits. So whatever lost profits they've lost as a result of that law being put into place, they can sue the community for. And in some places, that's extensive. So if you're sitting on top of an untapped natural gas resource, you know, a pocket of shale gas in places where shale gas exists, like the Utica Shale or the other shale areas in the Northeast and other places, that you can get sued for the value of the gas that can't be drilled in that community. And that could be several millions, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so That's the first line of threat. The second line of threat is attorney's fees. The law allows the corporation to recover attorney's fees to pay their own lawyers for suing the community. And all of these lawsuits are filed under a federal law that deals with civil rights. So the corporation is coming in saying to the community, you violated the corporation's constitutional civil rights here. And you owe us money because of that. You owe us money because you've taken away the resource, and you owe us money because we've now had to pay lawyers to sue you. And so when we say the law is not on your side, that's exactly what we mean, that the law has been set up to give punishment tools, these huge hammers, to the corporation to come in when you have a community actually defying the system of law that the corporation is trying to use. And those huge hammers come in to nail the community. If you're dealing with a rural community that only has a budget of, you know, $200,000 a year, you're looking at bankruptcy, that the corporation can come in and bankrupt the municipality. And most times it doesn't get to that, or hasn't yet, because the communities will run away, because the threat of bankruptcy and financial insolvency and all these things are so powerful that they eventually say, sure, put the frack wastewater injection well in, or put something else, whatever's coming in, because we don't want to face those, that outcome. And just recently, you know, not happy with just punishing the community, the elected officials and the municipal government and the community itself, the corporate boys, especially in the oil and gas industry, which are some of the nastiest people out there, have come after the lawyers. So in a recent case last year, I and my co-counsel, who's another CELDEF lawyer, got hit with a $52,000 fine penalty. The corporation made a motion to sanction us. So the corporation came into the court, filed a request that the court sanction us for making arguments that went against established law being the corporate law, which is in place now, and asking the judge to order us to pay their fees that they had to pay for, to put a certain series of motions in and argue certain points in the court. And she agreed with them and issued this $52,000 sanction award, which we're now appealing and doing everything else that we can to get rid of it, because we think it was issued wrongly. But it's a good sign of the times, which is that the corporation's not happy just going after the community to punish them and keep them from doing it again, but going after the lawyers to stop any lawyers out there who might think about representing the communities in these cases from doing so. And I think, again, it's part of the evolution. It's enabled us to show up a pattern in practice to more and more people. But eventually, unless enough people get their heads out of their asses about how bad the system is and understand that the large environmental organizations are not really helping anything, because they're playing in that same sandbox. They're just trying to tweak a couple things on being on the receiving end of this corporate system of law, that we're screwed. And until those folks and groups are not seen as allies anymore, but are seen as causing as much problems and trouble as the corporations themselves, I don't think we're going to get ourselves out of anything. So,
well, I have a few responses. One of them is that at the same time that the corporations are allowed to say, look, here are the future profits that will be lost because of our because we won't be able to extract this gas, or won't be able to pump this stuff down in there, or whatever they want to do. At the same time, if you argued that you owe me, that they actually owe the community because 17 children will die in the next 15 years because of the extra pollution, they would hold you to some completely absurd level of proof. I mean, even when they've already killed, I mean, to look at Love Canal or any other place, even when they have already killed people in the past, they don't, they hold this absurd level of truth. How do you know that it was our benzene that actually caused that cancer? But my point is that there is this precautionary principle in place, that what it always is protecting is the corporate profits and not the health of the planet, the health of individuals, the health of communities. There's this completely absurd precautionary principle in place. Yeah. So that's one thing.
It's actually even worse than that, although I agree with everything you said, which is that from a constitutional perspective, whereas the corporation can sue our governments, i.e. our cities or towns or counties, because they are government actors and must comply with constitutional guarantees, both in the state and federal constitutions. The corporations themselves are private actors. And so if you attempted to bring a constitutional lawsuit against the corporation for doing certain things, you can't, because the constitutional rights, the Bill of Rights, is only enforceable against public entities, against government. And corporations were careful 150 years ago, starting 150 years ago, to be qualified as private actors like you or I. And I can violate your constitutional rights at will because I'm a private actor. You don't have a cause of action against me for violating your rights. And corporations have very carefully shoveled themselves into the same place. So it's not just a protective system, it's actually DNA'd into the system that corporations as private actors can violate your constitutional rights at will.
So the next question is, and we've got about 5 minutes left, the next question is, how do you explore for me a couple possible future scenarios? One of them is sort of a business as usual, and one of them is your pessimistic scenario, and one of them is your optimistic scenario for resistance and its effects.
Well, pessimistic is that we're cooked. I mean, the climate change stuff that came out the other day is just one more thing. Like, we knew that already, but it's one more thing on top, which is that things are worse than we ever thought. So I think, you know, the pessimistic view is that corporate control over the communities will grow and we'll continue to lose any sense of self-confidence that we have any kind of role in building a new society, and we will move further towards fascism and dictatorship and centralized preemptive control and all those things that we've been seeing over the past 10 years greatly accelerate. On the optimistic front, we're seeing pockets of people in different states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and New Hampshire and Oregon and Washington State, Colorado, New Mexico, starting to rise up, take over their local governments and not play the same game anymore, and begin driving into the courts, making arguments in the courts, but also driving constitutional change textually. So in New Hampshire, in Ohio, in Oregon, we now have constitutional amendments that are running, which are an attempt to change the state constitutions over to allow communities to get rid of this corporate system of law and put something else in place. And so I think what you're going to see from an optimistic lens is small pockets emerging, connecting themselves together into what we see as state networks, where the communities come together and build these state networks and then drive state constitutional change and then join with each other to actually rewrite the federal constitution. And I think that, you know, the federal constitutional amendments don't do the trick, that we actually have an archaic system of law. The DNA has to be dug out and remade. And I think that doesn't happen probably for another 20, 30, maybe even longer. But that's not about waiting for it to happen. It's about making it happen in these pockets now and giving birth to a revolt and a revolution that eventually results in that kind of fundamental DNA change. And it's no different than the suffragists, the abolitionists, the populist movement in the late 1800s. We've just forgotten how to build movements. We don't know how to do it anymore. And we think movements emerge on Facebook or Twitter. And we have to relearn what movements are about and how they change things and what fundamental structural shifts have to take place. And until we do that, we're kind of on the pessimistic side of things. But that's the work that we try to foster.
There's a friend of mine talks about there's a difference between mobilization and organization, that you can mobilize a flash mob on Facebook, but that's radically different than organizing.
Yeah, and you can have organization without mobilization. So you have a lot of groups that will put an organizational structure together and claim all kinds of things. Like the Rights of Nature stuff has gotten sexy over the years because it's a huge new paradigm changing kind of thing. And it's getting some money and people are raising money around it. So they'll put an organization up, but they won't be doing anything on the ground. And so you've got some of that stuff happening now too, where people try to take advantage of those things without having any mobilization at the ground level. So the idea is the organizational structure has to keep up with the mobilization, but the mobilization animates the organizational structure. So, you know, the state constitutional change is very important, but it's been preceded by the building of an organization to support the infrastructure that's needed to drive those changes. And none of this is going to happen anytime soon, but last year, the New Hampshire House of Representatives, one-third of its members voted in favor of the constitutional amendment that we had put forward that made it to the House floor. So it's not impossible, and that's only with a very small number of people. It's just a question about finding more people, having more people understand the pattern recognition stuff, and then be self-confident enough to do something about it.
And the last question I want to make or comment I want to make is that you talked about going against established law and how you got sanctioned for that. And is it not the case that at one point, arguing that, human chattel slavery was, a bad thing, was that not against established law in the United States at one point?
It was, and arguing during the Civil Rights Movement that when separate but equal got decided in the Plessy decision, that there needed to be other decisions to overturn that. So lawyers argue that all the time, but unfortunately, corporations are very, very good at finding the judges that will levy sanctions for these types of things, even though what we're arguing about is a good faith argument for extension of existing law or creation of new law, which is the standard. The ethical standard that lawyers are held to. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't happen. It's just that's the trend right now.
Well, is there anything else you want to say today before we close?
No, I would just say it's, you know, just yesterday, and I know this is going to be broadcast later, but the valve turners, which were the folks to shut off the flow of oil between Canada and the United States in Minnesota, had their charges dismissed the other day. And so, you know, whether it's civil disobedience done in the name of environmental protection and community quality of life or the type of constitutional amendments and stuff that we work on, everything's needed. It's really just the people seeing that pattern practice coming to a series of recognitions about it and then having the self-confidence to actually do something about it. But I think it's going to take everybody working in every different realm to eventually force this system, which is really rotten to its core, to change over to something different.
I know I've said like 3 times, this is my last question, but like a bad rock band, I keep coming back. One last question. How do people find out more about you or the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund?
Best way is through our webpage. So it's celdef.org. So C-E-L as in Larry, D as in David, F as in Frank.org. And one of the most popular things we do are these democracy schools, which are 2-day trainings where we, in about 9 hours, expand out what we talked about today. Like the Interstate Commerce Commission, we spend an hour on just looking at how it was formed, where it came from, what its intent was, and what that means for regulatory agencies that we have today. So that's a popular item, and we now have it online, so if people want to take the school online, they can do that too.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Thomas Lindsay. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.